And good morning to everyone. Couple of notes. Justice Wright will not be participating on any of today's cases. Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this very first case, and that case is In Re Trust of Shire. Mr. Klaus, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dan Klaus. I represent the appellant in this case, Shirley Gronin. This case is, we believe, a case of first impression in the state of Nebraska, particularly under the Nebraska Uniform Trust Code. In fact, we believe it's one of the early cases in any state that has adopted the trust code pertaining to modification of trust. I believe it's also a case of first impression with respect to modification of trusts under the common law. When Jenny Shire died in 1948, she established a trust for the benefit of her daughter, Ruth Banner Gronin, and my client, Shirley Gronin, which was her granddaughter. She left $125,000 in that trust, and the terms of the trust provided that Shirley Gronin, or first Ruth Gronin, for her life was to receive $500 per month from principal and income. And after Ruth Banner Gronin died, Shirley Gronin was to receive $500 per month for her life. If there was anything left at the end when Shirley Gronin died, the residual of the trust was to be distributed to certain residual beneficiaries of the trust.
How much is the trust worth today?
Today it's approximately $1 million. As of the time of trial, it was about $981,000, although assuming that the trust is appreciated like many assets in the last year, it's likely in excess of $1 million, and it earns, at least as of the time of trial, $80,000 per year in appreciation. Yet today, it still pays $500 per month or $6,000 per year to my client, Shirley Gronin. In 1948, when the trust was first established, $500 per month would place the recipients in the top 10% of income earners in the United States. Today, that same amount results in the recipient being in the bottom 4% of income earners in the state. The trustee, Wells Fargo, requested the court to modify the trust to increase the distributions to my client, Shirley Gronin. Obviously, Shirley Gronin joined in that request. The trial court found that no modification of the trust should occur under either the trust code or under the common law, and Gronin has hereby appealed. We believe that there are two provisions of the trust code that permit modification of the trust, and we also believe that the common law also supports modification of the trust. I would note, as I indicated in my brief, that there were actually three bases upon which we argued in the trial court that the trust code permitted modification. One of those was 30-38-38. All of the parties tried the case in part on that basis. It was briefed to the trial court on that basis, and only after the decision was entered by the court did I discover that there's another provision under the trust code that makes that provision 38-38 inapplicable to trusts that did not vest before 2003, I believe.
And what does that provision relate to?
That relates specifically to modification of trust for change in circumstances.
When the doctrine of deviation, how does that play into that that statute?
Well, I think the 3838 may have been a codification or an attempt to codify the doctrine of deviation. However,
is that based on common law doctrine of deviation?
Doctrine of deviation was recognized at common law to permit trust to be modified for change, unanticipated change in circumstances. And we believe that that provision is applicable in this case as well as two other provisions of the trust code as well.
So was the common law or the doctrine of deviation argued to the trial court?
It was part of the argument that was contained within the provision of 3838. The circumstances are the same whether you would analyze it under 3838 or under the common law. Both of the provisions or the analyses would be the same.
Is the change in circumstances under the common law or the statute judged by an objective or subjective standard?
I believe it's a subjective standard, Your Honor. The issue is whether the settlor of the trust would have anticipated the circumstances changing, and would it have been the settlor's intent to continue with the terms of the trust in light of those changed circumstances. So I believe the question is, as in any case, the ultimate objective for this court is to interpret the intent of the trustee in light of the circumstances that exist.
The intent of the trustor.
I'm sorry. You're right, Your Honor. The intent of the trustor in light of the circumstances that exist. And here we believe the issue would be, would Jenny Shire, who was a settlor of the trust, have anticipated the circumstances that my client is currently living in and has lived in for some period of time.
The concept of inflation was not unknown in 1948, was it?
It certainly was not. And we don't argue that that is the only basis upon which the court should modify this trust. We believe, frankly, given the length of time and the magnitude of the changes that have existed over time, would support a change solely on the basis of inflation. But the facts in this case go well beyond that. We had a settlor who obviously valued education, provided for funds to try to educate her granddaughter with a college education. Yet, due to circumstances beyond my client's control, she was forced to drop out of college to care for her mother, the other beneficiary of the trust, because she developed Alzheimer's and could not live on her own.
The settlor left the house in Lincoln for a life estate for Mr. Grona, is that correct?
It did. She did, yes.
And they left that house and moved to Arizona?
They did.
Okay. And the court and the trust settlor set up a trust for Ms. Grona and then now Shirley Grona, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so she didn't give the money to them outright.
She did not.
Give the house to them outright.
Correct.
What does that lead us to believe?
Well, I think what that leads them, the court to believe is that she had two purposes in her trust. One was to provide a means of support for her daughter and then granddaughter. But she also certainly had a purpose to leave some residuary to heirs or distributees after Shirley Gronin died. And I think what's important in that instance, though, is to recognize that the settlor provided that both the corpus, the principal, and the income of the trust could be used to support Shirley Gronin. So to the extent you're weighing the purposes of the trust, I think it is clear that the settlor intended her daughter and granddaughter to receive benefits under the trust sufficient to take care of them. I think there was still a purpose beyond to provide a residuary estate for the residuary beneficiaries. And I think specifically in the context of this case where what is being requested by the trustee and Ms. Gronin would preserve both of those purposes. She is not seeking any distribution from the principal of the trust. The trust is now $1 million. That $1 million would stay intact for those residual beneficiaries. Well, she's not even asking, nor is the trustee asking, for all of the income to be distributed to her. What they're asking is for a portion of the income to be distributed to Shirley Gronin to provide for her current needs, which will still allow the principal of the trust to continue to increase, leaving funds available for the residual beneficiaries.
And some of those residual beneficiaries somewhat consented or acquiesced to this request, is that correct?
It is, or at least did not file a specific objection to doing so.
They used some language of such to the point that it does not affect the corpus of the trust or something of that
correct.
Nature?
Exactly right.
What does that really mean? What's the corpus of the trust at this point?
Well, I think at this point the corpus of the trust would conservatively be the principal of the trust, which is in the amount of $1 million. And I think what they are saying is certainly to the extent that Shirley Gronin can be provided additional resources out of the income that's earned on the trust without dipping into principal, they have no objection to that. And I think it's very important to recognize that in this particular case, the only beneficiaries that conceivably have objected are some that are unknown and potentially non-existent. I mean, the trustee did an extensive search to try to identify any beneficiaries of this trust, but recognized, given the fact that this trust has extended over 70 years, that there may be somebody out there that was not identified. It is those unidentified, potential, and potentially non-existent beneficiaries are the only ones who have objected. I'd like to reserve some of my time for rebuttal if there aren't any questions at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is it Ms. Carlson? Good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Krista Carlson. I represent Wells Fargo Bank, which is a successor trustee under the trust created by Jenny Shire's last will and testament. Although I'm an appellee here today, actually I'm aligned with the appellant. I agree with the appellant. The trustee filed this petition because it was the right thing to do, because it's the fair and equitable thing to do to give Ms. Gronin enough that she can live on. She's currently homeless, living in a 26-year-old vehicle that has serious mechanical problems that needs repair. She can't afford dental work. She has health problems. And that truck isn't going to last forever. And here's the trustee doling out this meager $500 per month from this trust fund when $1 million sits there potentially to be used. But
counsel, of course the facts of this case are compelling, but we are deciding not just the facts for this case, but the law for future cases. And what is the principle that you cite that would control the outcome of this case to the compelling facts which you're arguing? How, once we've crossed this threshold of modification, what is the limiting principle?
That may be unforeseen circumstances, truly unforeseen, that the settler of the trust was unable to anticipate that there'd be $1 million sitting there while her granddaughter was literally homeless and living on the streets, and that in that situation, it is equitable to embrace the doctrine of deviation and to allow the trust to be modified. Or there are two other avenues to get there, too, that Mr. Klaus didn't necessarily go into, but our briefs did. Under Section 3837, if all the beneficiaries agree, then this may be done. Now here, all the beneficiaries that are known have essentially agreed. It said don't invade the corpus of the trust, that you can use that income to increase the allotment to Ms. Gronin. The unknown beneficiaries may or may not exist, but if you look, there's a parallel between the trust code and the probate code. We cited in the brief section 30-123-124 that allow, if the known beneficiaries consent and agree, then they can bind the unknown beneficiaries, the unborn beneficiaries, those that can't be ascertained, with their agreement, with their decision to go ahead and increase that allotment. So you can either follow the avenue in section 3837E, which says the beneficiaries consent, or you can take the approach under 30-3837E and say, even if those beneficiaries do not all consent, then it's appropriate and it can be modified if it is not inconsistent with the material purpose of the trust. And here, it's not. You have two purposes of the trust. One, you have that the daughter and the granddaughter be provided for, and two, that something be left for those remainder beneficiaries. Even if you modify this so that the daughter gets $1,000 a month or $5,000 a month, we're not tied to that $5,000 number. Something would be better than nothing. We give her anything extra so that she can get her vehicle fixed and her teeth repaired. That's something. But even if you modify it just so she gets something extra per month.
How do we give guidance to the trial court judges as to what that amount would be?
Well, I think we have good testimony here from that professor from the university and from the trust saying the rate of inflation and the ratio makes it from 500 to 5,000. That 500 in that day's time is 5,000. Now we've got consistent testimony from two witnesses saying the appropriate amount is 5,000 and that does not invade the corpus of the trust. And I think that's key here, is that the amount that we're asking for does not invade the corpus. It allows that to be distributed to the...
You're contending that inflation was an unanticipated...
No. Inflation was, I'm sure, anticipated. What was not anticipated, well, frankly, the mother's Alzheimer's and the fact that the granddaughter had to care for her and ended up not able to finish her education was certainly unanticipated. But the circumstances, the total package of circumstances, that she would be living homeless on the streets while this big trust fund was there available, income from it was available, was certainly unanticipated.
But didn't the settler consider that when she left the house in Lincoln for them? that they wouldn't be homeless?
Honestly, I don't know what happened to that house. I don't know where...
The record's not clear, is it?
No, it isn't. I do not have an answer.
But doesn't that go to somewhat of the intent of the settler to leave that house in Lincoln, Nebraska for her?
Well, to make sure she wasn't homeless. Absolutely.
Which is the biggest concern today, is that she's homeless.
Right, and so I think that shows her intent that those funds be allowed to be provided for her daughter. I should leave 5 minutes of my time for the other appellee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blumenberg, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Blumenberg, and I am appointed in this matter to represent any unknown or unfound beneficiaries of this trust. This is a unique position to be in, as I have clients, but I don't know who those clients are. But I am under the impression that these clients would want to preserve as much of the assets of this trust as possible for their benefit. That is the position I'm coming forward with this morning to the Court. I am a human. I am aware of the circumstances of this case and the facts of this case, and they are unfortunate when it comes to Ms. Cronin, and I would not argue that at all. However, I do believe that the trial court reached the correct conclusion in this matter, and I also believe that this matter is...
So is there some kind of a line that we can draw as to whether or not beneficiaries can be found? And what kind of a record do we have as to whether or not beneficiaries were searched for in this case, and whether there's any possibility that the people you represent could ever be found?
That's a very good question. The Trust Department in this matter has used substantial resources to try to track down who these beneficiaries are, and they have come up, if you read the petition in this matter, with multiple theories as to who these people may be, and under any of the theories that they've come up with, there's potential different beneficiaries, all of which are unknown. And that matter, honestly, has not been decided by the court as to who these individuals are. If these individuals are defined, my role, quite honestly, goes away in this matter. But how those individuals can be found in the facts of this case is going to be difficult. This trust was done in 1947. She died in 1948. He invested at that point. The residue beneficiaries was put into 55 different shares going to a number of different individuals, all of which, other than the charities, are deceased at this point, thus passing according to their estates. And although there has been considerable efforts, those individuals have not been found at this point, which adds more difficulty to the case, especially from your conclusion. I understand that, but I still think that reviewing this should still be done under the laws of Nebraska 30-38-37, both B and E, and then also the doctrine of deviation. It's true, I don't believe the Nebraska courts have addressed this issue before, so this is a matter of first impression upon this court. However, I do believe our neighbors to the south in the state of Kansas have addressed this issue and have addressed it in a manner that is consistent with the findings of the trial court. That would be in the case of In re trustee created under the last will and testament of Darby, 234 Pacific 3rd, 793 from 2010, is a relatively recent case. And in that one, although the facts do not go as far back as they do in this case, the facts of that case are similar in the fact that the person had health concerns. The person was asking for more money for purposes of living on. And the trust in that case found that there should be no modification under laws that are substantially similar to the laws that are being addressed in this case. They looked to the trust code and said that in this process, it is appropriate that courts act with particular caution in considering a modification or deviation that can be expected to diminish the interest of one or more of the beneficiaries in favor of one or more of the others. Here, anything the court does with regard to the income beneficiary affects the other beneficiaries. No matter how small or big. In this case, the numbers that are being thrown about are increasing it from $500 a month to $60,000 a month. I would consider that to be...
$60,000 a year?
$60,000 a year, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
That would be an increase.
Yes, that would be an increase. But $60,000 a year is also a substantial increase.
But all the known beneficiaries have essentially said, this is okay with us.
Yes.
So can we draw some kind of a line in regard to unknown beneficiaries?
I don't think you can. I think every beneficiary, if you read the statutes 30, 38, 37, it says that all the beneficiaries must consent, and I think that those beneficiaries need to be found in consent in order for there to be a modification. 3037B also says that the modification is not inconsistent with the material purpose of the trust. I would invite you again to read the Kansas case that was previously cited. In that case, they found that it was not an income trust or a benefit trust. It was a trust where the individual is going to get a set amount each year. And the trust in that case did not set forth that it was one of those things. Because it didn't specifically set forth it was one of those things, the court determined it wasn't. I think you need to go back and read the terms of the trust. This trust is clear. Because it's clear, I think that, that's what you should go on. I would ask the court to follow the trial court's opinion and not allow for a modification in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 43 seconds, Mr. Klatz.
Thank you. I necessarily will be brief. I think there are three bases upon which this modification can occur. One, under 3837B, court can decide whether all beneficiaries necessarily includes beneficiaries that have not been found or identified. And I think it's important to look at the comments because the comments to the trust code say the probate code can be looked at as well. And Ms. Carlson referenced the point in the probate code where known beneficiaries combine to unknown. Second, and we didn't get a chance to talk about this, under 3837B, the concept is what does adequate protection mean? We don't believe it means it equals absolutely no diminishment. I think to the...
You may finish your thought.
Thank you. I think adequate protection occurs when the principle of the trust will maintain intact to provide funds for the residual beneficiaries. Ultimately, the court has to decide whether it would have been Jenny Shire's intent that $1 million be maintained in her trust for the benefit of beneficiaries she never knew, instead of providing some kind of reasonable income from a granddaughter that she didn't know. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The second case of the day.